Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Arboudian. In this hour, we explore why the Nazis came to Charlottesville, what the common patterns are among violent extremists, and how power can breed immorality and hypocrisy. Our next guest is a professor at the University of Virginia and the director of the Center for Media and Citizenship. He and his colleagues knew of the coming so-called summer of hate. They had discussed at length how to respond. Siva Vidyanathan is also author of 4 books, including Googleization of Everything. He joined us now to tell us what he experienced and what he learned from Charlottesville. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Siva Vidyanathan. It's great to have you back with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
You wrote this piece in the New York Times, Why the Nazis Came to Charlottesville, a really moving piece and a really important piece. I think something that many of us are thinking about. You wrote about how you and your community and your colleagues, you knew this summer of hate was coming. How did you know about all of this?
The Nazis, the Klan, they all announced their intentions on their social media platforms. And in every case, they requested a permit from the city. So they were never secretive about it. In fact, they're quite bold in their predictions of their influence and effect, in their predictions of their ability to turn out soldiers. And they're quite clear about their intention to hurt people. They would like to drive all ethnicities but their own out of this country, either harass us to the point where we're willing to leave or create some sort of chaos in society so that there is something close to a racial ethnic war and they're able to carve out their own independent ethno-racial state. This is not some secret. They're very clear about it. Their YouTube channels, their Facebook pages, their independent websites, their talks, their forums, they're all very clear about their goal. And while each group may have a slightly different route toward it or maybe a different orientation toward their short-term goals, basically they want people like me and my family out of this country or dead. So knowing that and having a lot of people in this city who have been paying close attention, and you know, remember, we are about 100 miles away from the capital of the Confederacy. So this is not a new phenomenon for us. These efforts have been a part of daily life for African Americans in Virginia ever since the end of Reconstruction. They've lived under various states of terror and threat from white supremacists. And so, you know, we have a lot of deep institutional knowledge about what the threat is and how certain these groups are about their willingness to instill violence and fear. But, you know, basically they announced their intentions and they said this would be the largest gathering of white supremacists in 20 years. And I haven't seen any numbers, but I don't have any reason to doubt that they delivered on their promise. Now, in addition, we have been the site of a series of visits, some of them small and impromptu. You know, occasionally we will go downtown and see around the statue of Robert E. Lee, there will be 10 to 20 white supremacists waving Confederate flags and toting around semi-automatic weapons. And they will just have their special, you know, masturbatory prayer services in front of their idol, Robert E. Lee. And, you know, occasionally citizens of Charlottesville will yell things at them or make gestures to make them feel unwelcome. But fundamentally, they, you know, they feel totally comfortable. This is now their destination. This is a vacation site for white nationalists and for white supremacists. So we've seen this consistently over the course of the last year. And then just July, we were the site of a fairly large and troublesome meeting of a Ku Klux Klan group from North Carolina. And they came up here to make a scene at our Lee statue in our park. And so we had sort of a trial run for that. And the police here had a trial run for that. But everybody knew that the August 11th event was going to be significantly larger. It was going to be many groups, between several hundred to several thousand white supremacists, that they would almost all be armed. And even if they weren't armed, they would be willing to use clubs and fists. And, you know, there was just no illusion. So we had a series of community meetings, many of which were led by clergy with clear strategies of how to respond. We had our city government and its lawyers working on ways to try to minimize the potential friction of their appearance here. We had the police, both local and state police, working on response strategies for many months. None of this was a surprise. And, you know, the university itself has a number of students who have come in a bit early. Either they live in some special housing, such as the specifically honored students who live on the lawn, the famous Jeffersonian lawn, but also a few other students, for instance, international students who might have come in a bit early. Some students whose leases started August 15th were, you know, preparing to come in early. And so we've had a small number of students here, and many local students, I mean, many students who've grown up in Charlottesville were already in town. So we weren't devoid of students, but we were fortunate in the sense that we didn't have the full collection of students that we will by this time next week. So, you know, we thought we were ready. We're as ready as a community can be. We also had a strong number of activists who were willing to, you know, stand up with their bodies, take blows, deliver blows if need be, and really serve as a barrier between these hate-filled groups and the people of Charlottesville. And I have to say, I'm tremendously proud of every element of that. I think as we've walked through the reactions and the fallout from the weekend, especially the groups that worked with our local clergy, civil rights groups, community groups, the NAACP, Black Lives Matter, but also our Jewish synagogue, our Catholic community, our Methodist community, our, you know, Unitarian community, our Southern Baptist community, our Lutheran community. I mean, they rose to the moment. And there was a moment on Saturday when many of the more notable clergy members of our community linked arms and formed a barrier to basically indicate that the white supremacists were not welcome in this town. And that was a tremendously brave thing to do. And they were among our bravest, but we also had students who, once we found out sort of last minute that the white supremacists had decided to do a last minute invasion of the University of Virginia and pull hundreds, if not thousands, of their troops onto our lawn, where children live. I mean, there are families that live on the lawn in these sort of very honored housing, historical housing. They truly frightened many children. They frightened many faculty members who live on the lawn, and they certainly frightened our students. But we had a lot of students who decided to stand their ground, who decided to, you know, protect the image of the university and not yield to these thugs who outnumbered them by many multiples. And we ended up with a terrible and violent situation on Friday night, which again was not planned and, or at least not announced. And so we all had to scramble to deal with that. But then on Saturday, of course, as you know, it turned deadly. So while we had injuries and humiliation on Friday night, on Saturday afternoon, we had a murder. And we had multiple citizens put in the hospital because they were beaten by white supremacists.
One of your quandaries was, you know, all of these discussions that your community had, how do you respond to all of this? And it sounds like that question, you're looking at it again, like, well, maybe my decision wasn't the best decision.
Right. Well, look, there are two schools of thought of how to respond to such moments. One school of thought, which has been fairly dominant, or at least loud over the last few years, goes as follows. That these groups are fundamentally small, weak, and cowardly. And what they desperately want is attention. You know, they're like stalkers. They're like, you know, sick, twisted little men who have nothing else going for them in their lives. And so what they desperately want is to feel important, to get an audience, to get someone riled up, to give some indication that they matter in the world. And I think that's a reasonable reading of the white supremacist motivation up to a point. The other school of thought is the one that you hear from people involved in direct action, people involved in the Antifa movement or in Black Lives Matter, but also many of the other, you know, community-based groups who feel it is essential to show community strength, to show that we, the anti-racists, outnumber the racists, that we will stand our ground and defend our community, and if need be, put our bodies at risk to protect our neighbors. Some of our neighbors are too vulnerable to make a stand. They're elderly or disabled. They are clear targets. They're children. So, you know, those two schools of thought, I think both of them are legitimate. Both of them have strong reasons behind them and are thoughtfully expressed. But to buy into the first school of thought, that this is only about attention, the best thing you can do is stand down, stand away, look away. You have to accept a couple of premises. Well, you have to accept the premise that, in fact, these hate-filled groups are small and weak. And the other thing you have to hope for is that everybody else in your community thinks as you do. Now, if everybody in Charlottesville had said, we think that this is all about attention, we're going to turn our backs, we're going to go about our business, we might even leave town, and we're going to let them have their little party in our park, and it'll be quiet, and people will just make fools of themselves, and it'll be over, and no harm done, right? If every single person did that, yeah, that might be the case. But realistically, CNN was going to be there. You know, realistically, the Washington Post was going to be there. Realistically, there were going to be hundreds of individuals with cell phones ready to capture video and put it on YouTube or Facebook Live or any other number, Periscope, or any number of broadcast media. And therefore, they were going to get attention. Right? The spectacle was going to get attention. If you don't have unanimity about this and a complete press blackout and a complete cell phone blackout, then they're going to get the attention that they want. In addition, you have to remember that the white supremacists themselves have phones, have Periscope, have Facebook Live, have YouTube channels. They were going to make it a spectacle, even if their opposition did not show up. Now, sure, there would be fewer bloody bodies if nobody showed up to confront them. But realistically, you also have to remember that there are people who will not stand for this and will stand up in between these hate-filled groups and decent people. And given that, someone's going to put his or her body on the line. I came to realize too late that I had made a mistake. Now, I study media. I wasn't naive enough to think that this was all about attention. But the other thing to remember is I believed, having read what I read and discussed what I discussed and followed what I followed, that these groups are in fact large, strong, armed, and willing to do damage. I had no illusions about that. But because they were coming armed, because they were coming with semi-automatic weapons, knives, handguns, you know, batons, clubs, baseball bats, I made a decision and my wife made a decision. We talked about it extensively. How close do we want to get? And we decided we don't want to be around firearms. It's just too risky. The potential of tempers getting too hot and someone opening fire, or even accidentally, someone opening fire and someone returning fire. The potential was too high. The potential for an officer of the law to misjudge a situation, or in fact, judge a situation correctly and have to open fire and thus start a bigger conflagration was just too high. And so we decided to take advantage of another option, which was presented by the university, where the university scheduled a series of very informative teach-ins with some real experts. Experts in the history of race, experts in the sociology of protests, experts in conflict resolution, experts in immigration. And we thought this will be a nice thing. We have an 11-year-old daughter. We'll take her to these talks so that we're with people during this time of stress. We're with people we love and respect during this time of stress. And along the way, you know, my daughter might learn something. And so that was our plan. It didn't turn out so well for a number of reasons. One, about 11 o'clock in the morning, the event downtown was scheduled for noon. But by 11 o'clock in the morning, the governor had declared a state of emergency and canceled the event, the right-wing event. And that was because at that point, for almost 2 hours, there had been hand-to-hand combat in the streets of Charlottesville. So given that they could not control the situation, the governor called off the event, thus making everybody scatter. As soon as the university recognized that the scattering might actually drive more white supremacists, more Nazis toward the university shut down everything and sent everybody home from these events. So we ended up back at home, huddled in front of the television with all of our devices connected to Facebook and Twitter and other social media platforms and video platforms, trying to make sense of the moment, getting texts from friends, getting updates from friends who were out there. And as the day went on, I realized that my friends and neighbors were protecting me. They were making a stand. They were taking blows. They were taking risks to protect my community and to protect me. And I remembered that the day after the election in November, when my daughter was so concerned about the fact that a sexual predator and a white supremacist was going to be president of the United States. And she asked, should we leave? Should we move to Canada or England? And we said, hell no. We're Americans. This is our country. We are going to stand up and defend our neighbors because we are not the most vulnerable among us. You know, we have neighbors who are recent immigrants. We have neighbors who are Latino, neighbors who are Muslim. They're going to be the obvious targets. And we told her we would stand in front of them to protect them. We would do all we could. And here I had let down my community. I had forgotten my promise that I made to my daughter and then I made to myself and I made to my community. And I let young black men defend me, several of whom ended up in the hospital. And I was ashamed, and I remain ashamed. I made the wrong choice. And contacted me to try to make sense of what had just happened. That's what I offered them. I said, I faced a moral dilemma, and I found myself wanting. And they appreciated that because they knew that I was not the only person who had faced this choice in Charlottesville or other places in the country or other places in the world, and I would not be the last to face this choice. And so I thought, you know, my thought process is not going to be unfamiliar to other people, or soon it will become all too familiar to people. And I want to invite them into how I thought, both before and after the event. And I didn't expect everyone to agree with me. And many people I respect deeply, told me that I did make the right decision on Saturday by staying home and staying with my family and protecting my family in a more local way. And I was too hard on myself. And then I had plenty of people agree with me, but mostly I think I started conversation. All over America, people read that and thought, okay, what would I do? And that's really what I want. I don't really fundamentally care whether people think I did the right thing or wrong thing, or that my ultimate decision was right or wrong. I wanted everyone to realize that at some point, the people like this will march through their town. They will have to face the same choice.
Sivu Vaidyanathan, I think you laid it out beautifully, both in the piece and just now. And in our last couple of minutes, because we both study media and we both teach media, mm-hmm. I wanted to get your take today in the face of what we are dealing with about free speech, so to speak, and the use of the internet to spread hate and to organize hateful events. Where do you stand on that now as a professor of media?
So I am right now much more concerned about the First Amendment issues surrounding the demonstration itself. When the white supremacist applied for the permit from the city to hold this. Now, one thing you have to understand about Charlottesville is it's a very compact town with very small city blocks all laid out in the 18th century. And our downtown is only about 20 blocks in area. We have a pedestrian mall that runs down the middle of it, which is usually closed off to traffic on weekends. It's closed off to traffic east-west, and there are a couple of cut-through north-south streets. The park in question, formerly called Lee Park, currently called Emancipation Park, in which sits the humongous, obscene statue of Robert E. Lee, that sits two blocks north of the downtown mall. Just as importantly, there is a synagogue a block away from it. There are five or six churches within a four-block area. There are residential homes, apartments, condominiums scattered throughout, all throughout that neighborhood. There are people who own businesses on the downtown mall and just beyond it who were worried about their property. Given that topography, the city approved the permit, but as is required by the First Amendment, but said the demonstration, the right-wing demonstration, has to move to a different park called McIntyre Park, which is on the north side of the city in a very open, grassy area where the police could set up clear lines and use barriers and could keep the white supremacists and the protesters against the white supremacists separate from each other and manage the crowd. And if there were a problem like a medical emergency, there would be easy access for emergency crews to come through. It would just be, and they had a whole plan to manage that. Friday night or Friday afternoon, right before the rally, a federal judge ruled, because the ACLU of Virginia filed suit, ruled that the city could not move the event to McIntyre Park and had to keep it downtown a block away from a synagogue. They did this despite the fact that the police and the city in their arguments to the judge said, we know that they are coming armed. We know that they have the intention of committing violence. And we know we have an estimate of the number of people coming and our downtown cannot handle it. And it will turn into a melee. It'll turn into what it turned into. And the judge rejected those predictions and said, took a very fundamentalist attitude toward this question. Now, remember, the city wasn't asking to cancel the event. The city was asking to just manage the time, place, and manner of the event, all of which are concepts allowed under First Amendment law, as with guidance from the Skokie case from 1978. And so it should have been allowed. But here's the thing. In Skokie in 1978, the Nazis who marched in Skokie to create an affront to deeply frighten and alarm and intimidate survivors of the Holocaust in Skokie, Illinois, they did so without firearms. They did so basically with just their bodies, and they walked through and they made their speeches. And that was it. There was no possibility of one of them opening fire and killing Jewish people in Skokie. In Charlottesville, there was a constant and increasing threat that one of their group would end up killing at least one of the residents of Charlottesville. And as we know, that happened. So First Amendment law right now in the United States does not take into account Second Amendment law, right? There's a huge problem now in the sense that if there are men standing in your street bearing semi-automatic weapons, there is no free speech. At that point, I am coward. I am not as I was, right? I was not able to exercise my First Amendment rights as a citizen of Charlottesville to stand on a corner and pronounce my opposition to their agenda because their weapons intimidated me, chilled me, and believe me, I was not the only one, and kept me home. In addition, the presence of their weapons was a signal, a communicative act about their willingness to engage in violence, which of course they did. So courts have not confronted this problem that currently the Second Amendment trumps the First Amendment, nullifies the First Amendment in any meaningful way, to the point where the speech act, the expression itself, is the man standing with the gun and not the words or ideas that emanate from human beings engaged in conversation. The First Amendment was meant not to create the environment of violent demonstrations and stunts the First Amendment was created to foster a republic, to allow citizens to engage with each other in knowledgeable, reasonable ways. We've made that virtually impossible because our gun laws have undermined that spirit. That's number one. But we've also reached, and this goes to your point, the point at which collectively it is almost impossible for us to think through our problems because we conduct our politics through Facebook and to a lesser extent through Twitter. When you render serious political engagement in those formats, which are not designed for deep engagement, for human compassion and camaraderie, you're going to generate a bitterness, a brittleness, and a shallowness of engagement that, again, our founders would be appalled by. They would say, this is not how we envisioned a republic. We thought that 240 years later, we would be Athens. Instead, we're Sparta. We're incapable of collectively facing our problems. We're incapable of collectively facing our problems of racism. We're incapable of collectively facing our problems of climate change. We can't even agree to disagree. And social media is not the cause of it, but it amplifies it because it's crowded out so many other forums through which we might engage civically. You know, and it's getting worse. And I'm writing a book right now. I'm almost done with this book called Anti-Social Media. It should be published in 2018, in which this is my core argument, that Facebook, by its ubiquity, its nature, its addictiveness, and the fact that it is almost necessary in our lives to conduct full social lives as adults, has then imported our political lives and rendered our political lives poor. In the meantime, because so much advertising money has flowed from traditional publications into Facebook, and publications, in order to get readers, have to pander their design and their content and their headlines to appeal to Facebook's algorithms, all of these magazines and newspapers upon which we used to rely for good information and for forums for debate are now feeding the very beast that is starving them. And that beast is Facebook. And so we're in a really rough situation, you know? At the same time, Facebook and to a lesser extent Twitter are phenomenal organizational and motivational tools. If you want to make people angry or you want to make people go, aw, because it's a cute doggy picture, nothing's better than Facebook. If you want to make people happy for you because you've had a child or honor you on your birthday, nothing's better than Facebook. But it's designed for the puppies and the children and the birthdays. And if we would only do that, Facebook would be a beautiful thing in our lives. I get to connect with my cousin, you know, who's in the armed forces and in Europe. And as his career goes forward, I get to cheer him on through Facebook. That's a beautiful thing. But the moment I try to actually delve into something serious, the structure of Facebook and Facebook's algorithms undermine my very purposes. And we end up organizing ourselves into tightly knit groups that all agree. We get short of temper. We find it difficult to express nuance. And what gets favored by Facebook are posts of high emotional registry or high emotional registers accompanied by graphics like images, video, photographs. Anything like that gets promoted by Facebook. Anything that is a long block of text, of thoughtful text, gets buried by Facebook.
Yeah.
And, you know, Facebook is designed for advertising and for puppies. And so that would be great if all we had there were advertising and puppies.
Yeah, there was that study about how they were filtering the information based on emotion and preventing people from having negative emotions.
Yeah, that was an internal experiment. They picked out an experimental set of Facebook users and tweaked their news feeds to try to measure their change in emotional level as measured by their own choices of expression, like whether you click the happy face, the sad face, the angry face. And, you know, it was an experiment, and Facebook intended and did, in fact, publish it in a peer-reviewed journal. So it wasn't something that it did to all of us. But the very fact that it had the power to do that level of manipulation, and its ultimate experiment results showed statistical significance in what they managed, and the very fact that they thought to do it was alarming, and the fact that none of the human subjects agreed to be part of it was a problem, you know, for basic social science reasons. Like, we were used, and Facebook, of course, never opens up its data to analysis because it's proprietary data, so no one can replicate that experiment. No one outside of Facebook research can replicate that experiment. I mean, there were so many problems with that. But it does go to show the extent to which Facebook has a tremendous amount of power, even though I'm happy to say it does not exercise that power to the degree that it is capable. The very fact that it's capable of that much power should give us pause.
Yeah. It's a little like Hotel California. You can check out any time you like, but you can never leave.
Exactly. I mean, this last week, if it weren't for Facebook, I would have had a hard time communing with my friends around the world. All of them wanted to quickly and sincerely and strongly express their condolences for the trauma we've gone through in Charlottesville, for the loss of life, for the hospitalization, for the fact that my community is going to take quite some time to heal from this and fight back. And so it's been essential, but it was also essential to get those guys into my town. They needed that sort of organizational tool to make this actually happen. We didn't see white supremacist rallies of this level before Facebook. And again, it's not that Facebook created the situation, but everybody knows how to play Facebooking and work the system at this point. And we're going to see more of these situations, not fewer.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, Siva Vaidyanathan. It's always a pleasure. It's always enlightening. Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening to me. And I do hope that, we all figure our way through this. We need to find a way to work our way out of this problem collectively.
Siva Vaidyanathan is a professor at the University of Virginia and the director of the Center for Media and Citizenship. He's also author of 4 books, including Googleization of Everything. When we come back, how can we better understand what makes people violent extremists? Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. Do violent extremists have common characteristics and backgrounds? Can we predict who among them will become violent? We're joined by Patrick James. He's a researcher at START at the University of Maryland, and he's the project manager for the Profiles of Individual Radicalization in the United States project. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Patrick James. It's great to have you here with us.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
So you have been studying radicalization. I thought the best place to start is in the U.S., the numbers that we see. How many people are we talking about, and how big are these radical groups?
It's really hard to say how many people exactly in the United States have radicalized. We draw a sample of U.S.-based extremists, and we have the largest database that we know of, and that stands at about 1,500. But we know that's just a small fraction of the amount of people who are active in extremist groups in the United States. I know there are at least tens of thousands of people who are sympathetic to these types of views.
One of the things I read about your study is that
something like 43% are in the far right ideological category. Is that right?
That's right. That's what we have in our data. And when we say far right, that's a very broad term for a lot of overlapping movements. So that typically is going to include groups like white supremacists, KKK, neo-Nazis, the type of groups that we've seen active recently in places like Charlottesville, but that also includes groups that hold specifically anti-government type ideologies, sovereign citizens, radical militias, anti-immigrant groups. So it's a very broad category that has a lot of overlapping movements. But that is right. About 43% of our data are classified as the far right, and that's the largest category that we have in the data.
You mentioned militia movements, the anti-government, the sovereign citizens, the white nationalists. I guess that would be include the KKK.
That's right.
Who else are you talking about when you say right-wing groups?
Specifically, we're talking about the KKK. They have dozens of chapters around the country. Historically, going back throughout the U.S., the modern sort of far-right movement really has its roots in the 1980s. Groups like the Order specifically targeted well-known Jewish Americans, and they had a few kidnapping plots. And then you really see this large growth of far-right groups, militias. A lot of them are sort of local chapters that aren't bigger than people. And now you really see this sort of coming together of a lot of these groups. They're meeting with each other online, be able to connect with one another, and able to come up and really have a show of force in places like Charlottesville. So it's really varied sort of movement with dozens and dozens of different types of groups.
So would you say, given what you just described to us, that the internet has really been a facilitation tool?
Absolutely. Facilitation, communication tool, and mobilization tool. The internet works to connect these groups instantly. In the past, to have any sort of functional extremist group, you had to, know them face-to-face, be able to have a secure meeting, physical meeting place. Now, in the past decade or so, especially now with social media, these individuals are able to find each other so much easier and form these online communities that sort of act as echo chambers, as meeting places, and places to swap ideas, and in some cases to mobilize in physical space.
When you look across all of the people that are in your database, I saw a quote from one of your colleagues, from Gary LaFrie, who I think heads the program over there. He said in the New York Times that the far right groups are really the most likely to commit violence, like what we saw in Charlottesville. Is there a trend that it's worsening?
It's hard to say if there's a trend. The data that we're going off of right now only goes through 2013, and we're working on updating the data set. And we haven't done any sort of trend analysis on the rates of violence. But what I can say is that he's right in that those on the far right are more likely to engage in violence than those who are motivated by extreme left-wing ideologies. But they're also sort of at the same level in terms of violence with extremists motivated by Islamists, ideologies like those inspired by Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Really, what we see in the data is that the far right and Islamists neck and neck when it comes to likelihood to commit violence, whereas the far left is far more likely to engage in activities that directly harm property, or they engage in vandalism or some sort of industrial sabotage, but they tend to not, in the past couple of decades at least, engage in direct violence themselves.
And then you've also been studying patterns or trying to understand how radicalization actually happens. So let's look at some of those factors. It sounded like, from what I read, it's so varied, it's hard to discern specific factors that are driving the radicalization, but there seem to be tendencies. So can we talk about some of those? One seemed to be ideology among the right wing.
Absolutely. You are right. It's hard to say. If anything that radicalization researchers agree upon, it's that radicalization is complex and that it's a complex process that doesn't unfold in a straight line. It's not linear. But what we can say is that we see across ideologies, so this goes for far right, far left, Islamists, and even those motivated by a single issue, so think like anti-abortion extremists, we see a pattern that those who radicalize in these what we call cliques, so these small insular groups of people, typically 3 to 12 members, when they isolate themselves from the rest of society, and you see these group dynamics kick in, like groupthink and group polarization, those types of people tend to engage in violence more often. We also see that those with some sort of criminal history, and again, this holds across ideologies, those with some sort of criminal history are more likely to engage in violence than those who don't have a criminal history. So we do see these commonalities sometimes across ideologies. In addition to those two factors, we see generally low levels of abuse, being victims of abuse, as well as drug abuse, or those sorts of risk factors that are commonly thought of to lead to radicalization. We don't see a lot of evidence for that. And we also see relatively low levels of mental illness. So I know that's often talked about when we discuss radicalization. Sometimes the bridge between mental illness and radicalization to violent extremism is sometimes blurred, and it's a complicated relationship. But the idea that extremists are crazy, that they're all mentally unstable, is something that does not hold out in the data.
Of course, it's hard to know that unless they have a diagnosis. And I can't imagine that it would be easy to know whether or not there has been a diagnosis in these cases. So it's hard to say on that.
Yeah, one of the challenges we have with the data is that we are reliant on open source material. So sometimes it is difficult to come across concrete diagnoses of mental illness. You're absolutely right.
So the other things I found interesting were demographics, commonalities, like people had traditionally thought that people who fall into these extremist groups tend to be poor, but that turns out to not be the case at all.
That's right. When we look at the socioeconomic background of extremists across the entire sample, the biggest group come from middle-class backgrounds. There is some slight variation. So those on the far right are less likely to achieve higher levels of education. For instance, only 25% of far-right extremists attained a college degree compared to 43% for the rest of the sample. And they're also less likely to come from a high level of socioeconomic background. That being said, middle-class background is still the most common thing. In terms of demographics, we find that there are some differences across the far right and the far left in Islamists. Far right extremists tend to be older, so an average age of 36 by the time they kind of come to public awareness, usually by their arrest, compared to 31 years of age for the entire sample. And they're also more likely to be male. 95% of the far right in our sample are male, compared to about 89 to 90% for the rest of the sample. We see the majority for every category of sort of ideological milieu is overwhelmingly male. The highest percentage of females we see is in the far left. About a quarter of the far left are females.
In terms of the radicalization mechanisms, you noted personal psychology and collective psychology. Just a little while ago when we were talking, you said, of course, there's things like groupthink and conformity. How does that all work out?
It's a complex process. The philosopher Immanuel Kant once said that from the crooked timbers of humanity, never a straight thing was made. And that really holds up when we think about radicalization and how it works at the individual level. So it's possible for us to draw these broad comparisons across ideologies. Looking at it and digging into it at the individual level, the process itself is difficult. But with some of the research we've done, using some methodologies that can handle this sort of idea of complexity, we can begin thinking of radicalization in terms of multiple pathways. And we found a number of conditions that really set the stage for active violent extremism. The first condition is what we call cognitive frame alignment. And that means a person undergoes some sort of fundamental shifts in the way they come to view the world. And perhaps more importantly, how they actually handle new information that they encounter, which runs against their belief system. So it kind of provides an environment for radicalization to take place, this sort of mental shift that disallows the person to think critically of incoming information. The second and probably more important condition, and I think more interesting one, is that we find when a person develops what we call a sense of a community crisis, it seems to be hugely important for whether or not they engage in violence. A community crisis is when they come to closely align or identify with a group that they consider to be under some sort of existential threat by a hostile external group. And we see this across ideologies. So for the far right, that's often manifested in terms of the federal government, which a lot of them see as run by some sort of conspiratorial Jewish shadow government. Or we also see it, for instance, in a lot of Islamists and Al-Qaeda type narratives where they see Muslims around the world being under threat from a hostile Western power. When people identify with a group that they see to be under threat, that seems to be one of the most important things that actually leads to violent mobilization.
Well, that would make sense. And given the media messages that some of their websites and even some of the more mainstream right wing put forward, it really starts to make logical sense that if they really believe that, they would be afraid and concerned and believe there's really an existential threat.
Absolutely. And a lot of these sites do a really good job at sort of packaging a narrative and selling it. They typically don't start out, you know, giving them the entire sort of narrative all at once. Usually it's a slow process that, you know, it's an incremental step process. But once you become fully committed to the ideology, it's a really compelling argument that, you know, for instance, for white supremacists, that the white race is being under a constant state of threat from a hostile federal government and hostile minorities who are trying to take some sort of position of privilege away from them. It becomes a really powerful motivating factor for a lot of these people.
And I imagine with the current president in the U.S. administration legitimizing these beliefs, it seems to make even more sense.
Absolutely. We've seen, I think, an uptick in hate crime incidents since November of last year. I know the Southern Poverty Law Center, they do a great job at tracking instances of hate crimes over time. And I believe they've seen a huge uptick since the current administration has taken over. But when you see that sort of rhetoric and that sort of messaging coming from the very top, it certainly doesn't help the situation any.
Finally, one of the things I thought were really interesting is that families don't really matter that much.
Yeah, we found that family members tend not to have a huge influence on whether or not someone's likely to be violent. We find that peers seem to really be the deciding factor of whether or not someone is going to behave violently or non-violently. However, families, I do think they play a big role when we think about intervention and prevention programs. People who are closest to an individual that's going on some sort of extremist path are going to be the ones who see them every day. And that's going to be their family members, sometimes their close friends. So there has to be some sort of space right now for family members who, you know, concerned mothers and fathers and siblings and other people close to the person. There has to be some sort of space for them to go to, be able to help the person, be able to get the resources they need to get the person onto some sort of off-ramp. And we see from all sorts of research looking at de-radicalization that the influence of the close family is very important to bringing people out of extremist groups.
So it doesn't bring them in as much as it does help to get them out.
I think that's where the research is pointing at this point, yeah.
Well, Patrick James, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for sharing your research with us on the Scholar Circle.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Patrick James, researcher at START at the University of Maryland, and he's the project manager for the Profiles of Individual Radicalization in the United States project. When we come back, does power breed hypocrisy? Does it encourage immoral and unethical behavior? More on that when we come back. Stay tuned. After a decade of ethics scandals, psychologists began to wonder, does power breed hypocrisy? That became the subject of a psychological study that looked at why powerful people, those who often speak in highly moral language, don't always do as they say. The study found that, in fact, there is a correlation between power and hypocrisy, whereby the powerful people hold others to high moral standards, but they tend to go easy on themselves. We have one of the authors of this study, Adam Galinsky, with us. Adam Galinsky is a professor of ethics and decision making in management at the School of Management at Northwestern University. Welcome, Adam Galinsky.
Thank you so much.
Well, it's great to have you with us. You found that power and influence themselves can cause what you called a severe disconnect between public judgment and private behavior.
Absolutely. That's what we found. Well, we found two sort of main effects in our studies, which I think are important. The first is that power leads people to act in an immoral or unethical way. And so what we found in our studies is that those people who were randomly assigned to experimental conditions in which they had power in our experiments were more likely to cheat in games, were more likely to say that it was okay to fudge expenses, a number of different things. And so one of the key things that this research shows is that although there are more eyes on the powerful, ironically, the powerful feel psychologically invisible, and that then licenses them to act in all of these immoral ways. You could think of power as very much like the Ring of Gyges of Plato, which is popularized in The Lord of the Rings, like exactly what Gollum and Frodo were after, was this cloak of invisibility that then unleashed all of this selfish, self-interested, you know, behavior. But that doesn't make them hypocrites. That just makes them immoral. What makes the powerful hypocrites is they simultaneously hold others to higher standards than they hold for themselves.
Now, I wonder if this would have some explanation to the historic Stanford prison experiment where they randomly assigned students to be prison guards or prisoners, and the prison guards really got abusive.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a contemporary explanation of that. These Stanford undergraduates are randomly assigned to the role of either prisoners or guards. The guards abused their power, tended to almost torture the people, act in ways that satisfied whatever their self-interest were, and then held these people to a very narrow band of acceptable behavior of the prisoners.
You found also that this phenomenon depends somewhat on a sense of legitimacy or a legitimacy. What did you mean by that?
We know why the powerful act immorally, right, is because they feel psychologically invisible. It's like this, you know, cloak of invisibility that licenses them to act in a way that satisfies their self-interest. The reason why the powerful hold higher standards for others, I think, is two mechanisms. The first is it's a way to control other people's behavior, right? If the powerful can hold other people to high standards and punish them when they deviate from them, that's one mechanism they can hold onto their power. Mm. The second thing is that they feel, in some sense, as in their position of authority, that that's what they're supposed to do. That's what they're legitimated to do, right, is to hold standards and structures of authority for other people. And so we found in our studies that when people are in positions of power, but they were concerned about the legitimacy of their position or whether they truly deserved it, then we saw some of this hypocrisy start to disappear. And in fact, we saw, in some ways, ironically, the reverse, where the powerful became harder on themselves than they were on others in states of illegitimacy.
You talked a little bit in your study about a sense of entitlement.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if, in fact, the sense of entitlement came first or if it came later.
Meaning, so whether people have a sense of entitlement and act immorally achieve positions of power, or whether power causes them to have a sense of entitlement and act immorally?
That, as well as the sense of power leading to the sense of entitlement leading to the immoral behavior. What comes first, the chicken or the egg?
Yeah, I think it's a complicated thing. I think that for the first question, we know that at least power has some causal force in this because we took people in the lab, randomly assigned them to either a powerful or powerless role, and saw dramatic changes in the standards they imposed on others and their own behavior. I think that probably there's a sense that when you put people in the position of power, they do feel entitled, and that entitlement allows them to both act in a way that satisfies their own self-interest, even when it's immoral, such as cheating, and license them to impose strict standards on others.
Now, you mentioned this psychological invisibility, which maybe it's not invisibility so much as accountability, is my guess.
Absolutely.
A little less invisible, a little more accountable. What explains this hypocrisy element?
I think part of the hypocrisy element is just two different forces going in opposite directions. And humans are rationalization, justification machines. We are very good at rationalizing things. And people in power, I think, don't notice that there is this disconnect between the standards they impose on others and their own behavior. I'm sure they have lots of justification reasons why it made sense for me to cheat in this case for these reasons, but that doesn't mean that I'm really acting in a violation of these standards. And I think something else you said before, which is very, very important, which is the word accountability. And that comes with solution to this problem. I think the reason why the powerful act in such hypocritical ways is especially when they're not being held accountable for their behavior. And research on corporate governing boards, boards of directors show that they fail very often in fulfilling their fiduciary duty, which is to serve a control mechanism for CEOs. We see this throughout the world with governments. When there's a check on the balance, either through the judiciary or legislator on presidential or prime minister activities, then we see less abusive behavior. So one of the key solutions of our research, I think, is to say finding ways to make those people, CEOs, presidents, prime ministers, whoever it is, to feel accountable and therefore have to explain and justify their behavior, I think would lessen this problem.
I was actually going to ask you about political and social implications of this. But as I was thinking about this, we as a society grant power to people all the time. We grant power to our representatives, our presidents. And it is really difficult to have these limitations placed on these because of the amount of power that they have.
Well, I think, you know, power is a central animating force in social life. There's no question about it. And some other research that my colleagues and I have done have said basically hierarchy, right, where some people have more power and some people have less power, is the most common form of social organization in the world, right? And in fact, not just among humans, but among species. And the reason why is that hierarchy solves lots of problems. It solves coordination problems. It solves conflict problems. It gives people incentives to work hard and to motivate performance. And so once we give people power, oftentimes it seems very well deserved because of all of those processes. But you can still have people in positions of power and still hold them accountable. And I think that one of the things, one of the metaphors I like to use is, how do you turn power into leadership? Well, think about driving a car. Well, what do you need to do to drive a car? Well, you have to press on the gas. You need acceleration to go somewhere. But you also need a steering wheel so you don't crash into things. So what power does, it kind of gives you that pedal, that acceleration, but we need accountability to give people better steering.
Finally, I wanted to talk about the people who didn't have power. And they were much harder on themselves,
yes.
And they were more lenient on others' moral transgressions. Talk about that.
Well, I think a colleague of mine at NYU, John Jost, has written a lot about what, you know, going back to sort of Marxist theories of false consciousness and talking about this idea of justifying the systems that we're in, even when those systems discriminate against us. And I think, you know, he's shown in a lot of his research that there's a number of psychological processes that low-power people do that conspire to keep them in low power. And I think this is just one of those processes in which the powerless by being harder on their own behavior and being more lenient towards others sort of keeps them in a place of subjugation and sort of helps reinforce the social hierarchy.
And so you've got to start to think about how do you resolve that issue as well.
Right. And I think, you know, one of the ways to do that is to also, you want to make people feel empowered who are below, and you want to make people above feel accountable.
It seems like it's this catch-22 as well, where the more power you get, the more you're willing to voice your opinions and less sensitivity you have to social disapproval gives you more power.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, one of the irony things of power is that to get power, you have to be a pretty good perspective taker. You have to understand the desires of those with more power. But once you get power, you tend to lose that capacity.
Well, thank you so much, Adam Galinsky, for joining us. Adam Galinsky is a professor of ethics and decision making in management at the School of Management at Northwestern University. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.